during this talk we have much ground to cover, so I'll try to limit it to the main points. And the talk will be about Dukkha Nupassana and Anatta Nupassana, but only the main points, don't worry.
Okay, השיחה הזאת של הרבה מנחצות, אז זה כנת חוסר סיפוק, חוסר שביעות רצון, ואנטה נופסנה, חוסר התבונן את זה חוסר.
The Pali term dukkata can be translated as the state of suffering or unsatisfactoriness of existence.
אז המילה דוקטה בפאלי יכולה להיות מתורגמת כהיות במצב של סבל או של חוסר סיפוק.
And the Buddha speaks of three kinds of suffering. And those three kinds of suffering are, number one, suffering in the form of pain, dukkha dukkata, suffering inherent in formations, sankhara dukkata, and finally, suffering in change, viparinama dukkata.
אז יש, הבודה מדבר על שלושה סוגים של סבל, דוקה דוקתה, שזה סבל כסבל, what's the name of the other, the next, the second?
Sankara dukkata.
Dukkata, שזה דוקה שמקורה בתופעות, ואניצ'ה דוקתה, שזה דוקה או סבל שמקורו בשינוי.
Viparinama dukkata. Dukkata is the last one. So, and so, so suffering is a fact of life, and this suffering can be brought to destruction. And the Eightfold Noble Path is to be developed for direct knowledge of these three kinds of suffering, and with this then, with the full understanding of these three kinds of suffering, comes their utter destruction, their utter abandoning.
אז הנציג בעל שמונת השלבים צריך להיות מתורגל כך שהוא יגרום להבנה של שלושה סוגי הסבל האלה, וכשההבנה הזאת תשג מעצמו הסבל הזה יעקר ויהרס.
Now, briefly, what is meant by suffering in the form of pain, dukkha dukkata? This refers to unpleasant bodily and mental feeling as actually felt.
אז המשמעות של דוקה דוקתה, סבל שמקורו בכאב, זה בעצם מנטליות בלתי נעימות כפי שהן נחוות.
Now, the second form of dukkha, namely suffering inherent in formations, refers to the oppressive nature of formations of existence, owing to the fact that they continually arise and pass away.
אז הסוג השני, הסבל שמקורו בתופעות, זה סבל שהוא בעצם אינהרנטי לתופעות, כל הזמן ממשיכות להופיע ולחלוף, להיעלם.
And this covers all sorts of feelings, pleasant, unpleasant, as well as neutral feelings.
וזה כולל רגשות נעימים, בלתי נעימים וניטרליים.
And then finally, we have the suffering in change, viparinama dukkata, and this refers to pleasant bodily and mental feeling.
והסבל שמקורו בעקביות או בשינוי, הוא מתייחס בעצם לאובייקטים נעימים, מנטליים ופיזיים.
And so the explanation is, if you have some pleasant, if you experience some pleasant object, and there's a pleasant feeling connected with it, if it changes, you lose the pleasant feeling, and that is suffering. Now, regard to the dukkha, first of all, the characteristic of unsatisfactoriness or suffering, dukkha lakana, is is oppression or suppression or obstruction.
בקשר לדוקה, המאפיין הראשון זה הטבע של דיכוי, suppression
or obstruction in oppression. I'm sorry. Never mind. That's okay. Okay. And this happens when one sees formations as one wants formations to last or to be permanent, yet they keep changing all the time. During one of the interviews, one of the meditators, in a very clear-cut manner, said, "Huh, I try to observe the rising and falling, and it keeps changing all the time. It's really unsatisfactory. It's really a hassle."
אמר שהוא מנסה להתבונן בעלייה וירידה, אבל הם ממשיכות כל הזמן להשתנות, וזה מאוד לא מספק, לא מצביע את
רצונו. Now, some further explanations, quick explanations regarding the first type of suffering, namely suffering in the form of pain. This kind of suffering we experience all the time in our meditation practice and even outside of the meditation practice. Whenever some unpleasant physical or mental formation occurs. And so it covers all the many pains and aches and hardness and burning sensation as well as difficult mental states.
אז הסוג הראשון בעצם סבל שמקורו בכאב, אנחנו חווים אותו כל הזמן, את כל התחושות הבלתי נעימות, נעימות, כאב, תחושות של...
And just for slight elaboration, under mental suffering, the following mental states or mental conditions can come, such as sorrow, lamentation, anger, rage, hatred.
אז זה כולל כמובן גם מצבים מנטליים בלתי נעימים.
Piety, grief,
evil,
distress,
sadness,
depression, fear. Okay. Further explanation regarding the second type of suffering, namely suffering inherent in inherent informations. And you wake up in the morning. And then you wash your face and or you take a shower and then you dress the body. Now the body with this is clean. However, and it would be nice if it would remain clean throughout the day, throughout the following days. But is this going to happen? Not. And so this in itself, the fact that things keep changing all the time, that for a while we're clean and after a while we're dirty again. So we have to look after this body again and again. This is a form of suffering.
אז סבל אינרנטי לתופעות, וקננדה נתן את הדוגמה שאנחנו קומים בבוקר, אנחנו מתחלחים, מתלבשים, בעצם הגוף הזה לא יישאר נקי לאורך זמן, אלא מהר מאוד הוא ישוב ויהיה מלוכלך. ועצם זה שדברים ממשיכים ומשתנים כל הזמן והם לא נשארים אותו דבר, זה גורם ל...
Just imagine if we could eat just one single meal in a lifetime and then have to go to the bathroom only one time and that's it, and then and then we have plenty more time for meditation practice and other activities.
דמיינו לעצמכם כמה טוב היה יכול להיות אם היינו יכולים לאכול רק ארוחה אחת כל החיים שלנו וללכת רק פעם אחת לשירותים.
Because we don't have to worry about brushing the teeth and problems like diarrhea and getting constipated and so on. These are examples for this sankhara, dukkata, suffering inherent in formations, inherent in the fact that we have a body. And a further elaboration for the third kind of suffering, viparinama, namely suffering in change, comes with the help of the famous ice cream. So you get after a long retreat of 10 days and much hard work, you really deserve to get a nice ice cream. So you go to the ice cream parlor in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or wherever, and then you have your ice cream. And so you enjoy it very much. However, you're under time pressure, your family is calling you, and so on. And so you know, the pleasantness that comes along with eating the ice cream doesn't last. When we don't practice, most likely we won't discover or uncover this characteristic of new suffering. We have a tremendous ability to create or to chase after pleasant experiences one after another. It's creating an illusion that life is pure happiness. There's one important factor that very much covers up or obscures the characteristic of suffering, and this one discovers through or during meditation practice. Back to the very beginning of our retreat here, the very first Dhamma talk, especially the instructions, there was mentioned at least once, please try to sit as still as possible. When you try to sit still, you will notice that the body doesn't want to sit still. It wants to change all the time. It wants to change posture all the time. And so this continuous or frequent change of posture obscures the universal characteristic of suffering. At home, when we sit on a sofa or some other comfortable chair, as soon as the slightest physical discomfort arises in the body, we change the posture, and we're not even aware of it. So, because we change so frequently, we can't see the suffering that lies behind it. In the meditation practice, there is also mindfulness mindfulness of postures, and gradually one discovers how these frequent changes of posture cover up suffering. We experience unsatisfactoriness or dukkha in the course of the meditation practice. First of all, when we start practicing, after within a few days, well, some pains arise, and on top of this, the five hindrances will be there, and they cause us much suffering. Eventually, a meditator will overcome these hindrances, will also temporarily overcome the physical pains, and with this, the first insight knowledge arises in the form of the discernment of mind and matter. It continues, and he or she will discover that formations are connected by cause and effect. During this phase of the practice, the characteristic of some amount of suffering might be experienced. So the meditation progresses, as one's meditation progresses, one observes the rising, falling of reed and other objects really carefully, and one discovers change. And with this, impermanence is understood. However, as one goes on observing the predominant objects, one finds that this continually changing objects in itself is a form of unsatisfactoriness.
אבל כשיוגי ממשיך לתרגל, הוא מגלה שעצם העובדה שהאובייקטים כל הזמן משתנים זה מצב של חוסר סיפוק.
One wants to have the time to look more carefully, and one cannot because the object keeps changing all the time.
אז אם אנחנו רוצים להסתכל יותר מקרוב, ואנחנו מנסים להסתכל מקרוב, אנחנו לא מצליחים כי האובייקט
משתנה. And then a meditator will continue with his or her practice, and then sooner or later the knowledge of the fast arising passing away formations will take place. Tender, initial and tender phase, that's the so-called imperfections of insight arise, and during which meditators experience plenty of rather intriguing mental states, wonderful mental states.
בשלב הראשוני של הידע הזה יעלו השחצות של התובנה שבזכותם או כשהן עולות היוגי יחווה הרבה הרבה מאוד מצבים מטליים נעימים ומפתים.
The teacher very much gets attached to these experiences, and then the understanding of dukkha, of suffering that was earlier there, this kind of fades away again.
שהיוגי מאוד נקשר למצבים הנעימים האלה ומתלהב מהם, אז אני
is wise and skilled, and then he or she understands that one should not get attached to these pleasant mental states, and then and not to get attached to them and see this continuous arising of them as unsatisfactory, then again we have some understanding of dukkha there.
אבל אם יוגי הוא נבון ומיומן ורואה שלא כדאי להתקשר לתופעות האלה ולהאחז בהן כי הן חולפות, אז שוב אנחנו יכולים לראות איזשהו
דבר. With further practice, a meditator comes to see only the, or mostly the dissolution of certain formations, and this in itself is still is still okay. It's, at times it's unpleasant.
אם מתקדמים עוד, אז היוגי יבוא לראות את העוליות, לא לחייב, אבל יכול להיות בלתי נעים.
And if one then continues to practice, all of a sudden some very unexpected experience may take place in the form of maybe fear or shock and so on.
ואם עוד יוגי ממשיך אחרי השלב הזה, אז בצורה של פחד או שוק או משהו כזה.
Now, this fear, of course, is not a fear of enemies, but rather a fear that is connected with wisdom and that arises out of seeing the dissolution of formations.
והפחד הזה הוא לא פחד שמקושר עם אויבים או איום חיצוני, אלא פחד שנובע מהתרגול.
Experience is quite intense, then there can be a lot of dukkha going along with it. However, it's important to just take it as a practice related phenomenon and to be aware of it, and that's all, and let it pass. After this, two further insight knowledges will unfold, and both of them are also very much characterized by the universal characteristic of unsatisfactoriness, dukkha. One of them is that one sees formations as mostly miserable, and after that one sees formations as disgusting. During that phase of the meditation practice, you might encounter thoughts of giving up and rolling, figuratively speaking, the mat. However, these experiences, very direct experiences of unsatisfactoriness, are absolutely necessary for the further development of one's meditation practice, for the attainment of Nibbana. Because as long as you're holding on, as long as you're attached to physical and mental formations, you won't be able to reach Nibbana. Nibbana can be reached only if there's a total letting go. So your practice will unfold further. Sooner or later you will experience some more suffering, but I won't go into this. And sooner or later you'll come across much equanimity about formations. And so eventually when the mind or the controlling faculties are well balanced and well developed, then the mind might land on a particular object and see it or observe it in the mode of suffering, and thus this serves as gateway to liberation. And with the practice or contemplation of unsatisfactoriness, we gain the benefit of abandoning the wrongful perception as pleasure, taking formations as pleasurable.
No
longer believe that these five aggregates are an origin and a cause of happiness. With this contemplation of unsatisfactoriness also comes a change of the distortion or an abandoning of the distortion of perception, of consciousness and view. When you see again and again that formations are not conducive to pleasure or to happiness, but rather that they're full of suffering, and then this changes your perception. And the change of perception will have an effect on consciousness itself, and this in turn will have an effect on one's views. That we see formations as unsatisfactory or as certain suffering should not be a reason to become pessimistic. In the meditation practice, we just see formations for what they are, according to their reality. In the course of the meditation practice, we learn to face certain suffering as suffering, and to deal with it properly, and eventually we learn to accept it and to be very balanced about it, and then there's no more problem whatsoever. This training in meditation thus helps us to face suffering not only in meditation itself, but especially on the outside and during our worldly life. Meditators can no longer handle certain kinds of suffering. We as meditators have no problem with it. So either by simply observing the suffering, it will sooner or later disappear, or by way of reflection, if we know in advance that even the greatest pain or the greatest mental pain sooner or later will dissolve, because it's impermanent.
או על ידי הרגור, שלא משנה כמה גדול הסבל, בסופו של דבר הוא מוכרח.
Is your guiding dukkha? Now let's continue. Now with the exploration of anatta, which is the third universal characteristic. And so to challenge you a little bit, there's a verse from the Visuddhimagga, and it runs, it very much brings across the idea of anatta. Where suffering exists, no sufferer is found. The deeds are, but no doer of the deeds is there. Nibbana is, but not the man or woman that enters it. The path is, but no traveler on it is seen. So, do you understand? So, Professor James, an American psychologist, has phrased it in similar words regarding thinking, and he says, the thought is the thinker. There is not I am thinking, there's just the thought. Or we could say feeling is, the mental factor of feeling is, but no experiencer of it.
No,
just like the contemplation of impermanence abandons the wrongful perception of permanence, just like the contemplation of suffering abandons the wrongful perception of the pleasure, so too the contemplation of anatta, of non-self, abandons the wrongful perception of the existence of a self. Look at the etymology of the term anatta. It consists of two parts, namely the an and the prefix a and so a or an. And then atta. The term anatta can be etymologically interpreted as either na atta or an atta. In both cases, the prefix is a negative marker. And atta here refers to a so-called apparent or distinct self or soul or person or being. No, apparent, clear, distinct. When you read through the text, especially the Suttanta, the basket of discourses, you will find many statements of the Buddha where he refers to himself, or where he still makes use of personal pronouns, and so on. However, don't let this mislead you. And the Buddha himself says that such kind of words are worldly designations, worldly terms, worldly expressions, worldly concepts, which the Tathagata expresses without clinging to them. And in our discussion of anatta, it's very important that we make this distinction between conventional reality and ultimate reality. So, on a level of conventional reality, for the sake of clarity and clarity, we make use of personal pronouns such as I and you and he and so on. into possessive pronouns, but ultimately speaking, there is no meaning to this. Question whether a self or an ego exists or does not exist is a hotly disputed question, and not only at our present age but also in the past, and it will continue to be a hot issue in the future. There are many, many philosophers and spiritual seekers who say that such a self or soul exists. So the Buddha's teachings very much go against these well, concepts of a self. We can say that the Buddha, in spreading his teachings, was as if rowing against, rowing, being in a rowboat, and rowing against the current of the stream, rowing upward, up the stream. Philosophers and spiritual seekers have missed the very functional nature of phenomenon. The Buddha has defeated the notion or concept of itself in four main ways. The first one is, and this is what you're doing here in your own meditation practice, by continuously examining physical as well as, or by continuously examining what is happening in this so-called being, eventually you come to understand that there are only physical and mental phenomena, and that's all. Otherwise, one could say you see the five aggregates there, or the elements, or the sense sense spheres, but there is no sense, no self to be detected. Any meditator has certainly gained or gains the second insight knowledge and understands that all physical and mental formations are related by cause and effect, and then the implication here is that there is no need for a so-called controlling self. The third approach is as follows. Once one sees that sees and acknowledges that formations are impermanent, and one knows that, and out of this one understands something of the suffering nature of formations, then once they're impermanent and the suffering, then how can they be subject to a self? And so the last way of defeating this concept of the self is by an assumption. If we suppose that a self truly exists, then this self should have certain qualities, such that it is permanent and such that it is in control of things. However, when we look at human existence, we find that things are not permanent and they keep changing all the time, and secondly, that major events in our life, plus even in the meditation practice, don't follow our will. So even if we don't want to die, we will die. Even if we don't want to fall sick, we will fall sick sooner or later.
אנחנו מניחים שאם היה קיים כזה עצמי, אז היו צריכות להיות לו תכונות של קביעות ותכונות של שליטה. אבל לעומת זה, כשנחתה, אנחנו מגלים שגם התופעות משתנות כל הזמן. אנחנו לא יכולים במה שקורה, אנחנו לא שולטים בכך שנמות, אנחנו לא שולטים
בכך. Where does this concept of an I come from? The Buddha says this is an imagination. So the thought I am, or to take it one step further, I am this, or to take it yet another step further, I will be this or that. All of these are imaginations. And so these are imaginations because they are based on four very potent mental defilements, and these defilements are ignorance for one thing, and then craving, and then pride and conceit and wrong view. ignorance. Now, when we observe really carefully with mindfulness the seeing process, and then it's not I am seeing, but rather there will be some visible object. There is the eye to see with, the physical eye, and when the visible object and this physical eye come together, then seeing consciousness arises. And based on this, or the coming together of the visible object, the eye, and the naked, the physical eye, and seeing consciousness, this is known as contact. Contact is just a physical, it's just a mental factor, and so based on this certain contact then arises feeling, and so whatever is felt is then also perceived. So what we find, what we see with this is that it's not I am seeing, there's not a self that is controlling the seeing process, but rather this is a very functional process that happens in a very structured manner. And the same thing goes for the other sense-door processes. Now, as human beings, we have a tremendous tendency to identify with, to identify the self with certain things, namely with one or two or all of the aggregates, the five aggregates. So we think that this body of ours is or represents the I. Or we think that the feelings that we experience, that's that must be me. Or the same thing for perceptions, the many perceptions that we're having, this must be identical with the self. And then the various kinds of mental states that we experience are then identified with the self. And so very easily we say, I am angry, I feel happy, I feel sad, and so on. These kind of statements reveal that the meditator has not yet seen the functional nature of formations. And most or the deepest identification is with consciousness, the aggregate of consciousness. So this thing is taken as an I. And in the text, 20 forms of wrongful beliefs are mentioned with regard to a self, and those are the belief to regard the material form as a self. Regarding material form as self. So there are five of these. And they cover the five aggregates. Then there is the notion that or the five wrongful beliefs that regard the self as possessed of material form. Differently, the self is supposed to be contained in those five aggregates. There's another five wrongful views, namely thinking that the self is independent of these five aggregates. And the last five are that the self is the owner of these five aggregates. Now, when we practice the meditation, and we progress through the different insight knowledges, and then gradually the sense of itself gets weakened more and more. And so the first step in this regard occurs during the first insight knowledge, when a meditator after a while realizes that the rising and falling is not my rising and falling, but just rising and falling, and that the pain is not my pain, but just the process, just pain. And so, furthermore, when a meditator keeps observing the different phenomena in this so-called being, and he or she finds in the end that there are only physical and mental formations. In this way, the notion of a self gets weakened to some extent. And then, when a meditator continues to practice and sees that all physical and mental formations are connected by cause and effect, where is the self in this? Where is the controlling self in this? There's no more space for it. I point that the notion of a doer, the self as a doer, this falls away. And so this can be seen as a strong punch at the self. And then meditator continues to practice, he or she will come to understand the impermanence of formations, will also see the unsatisfactory nature of formations, and finally the understanding of anatta grows. And so during this contemplation of anatta, anatta nupassana, a meditator will see in a very intuitive manner, very clear manner, events, formations such as the rising and falling are happening of their own accord. And it's not, there's no no self or person involved or doer involved who makes the rise and fall happen in a certain way. And during the previous phases of the meditation practice, a meditator still was under the impression that he or she is in control of things and can manipulate the rising and falling and make it a little bit longer, a little bit stronger, and so on. However, when this anatta nupassana takes place, then this certain perception changes drastically. In the walking meditation, a meditator may find that all of a sudden the walking is happening as if by itself, automatically. Moving an arm, it's not I'm moving the arm, but the arm is moving by itself. This is the first profound understanding of anatta. Now, when a meditator continues to meditate and then continues to progress, during the knowledge of dissolution, when one sees again and again the dissolution of formations, a very strong sense of emptiness arises. That then is or represents the one particular aspect of anatta. And then during the later insight knowledges here and there, there'll be some understandings of anatta, but anatta becomes very predominant with the arising of the knowledge of equanimity about formations. And so actually this knowledge or this understanding of anatta occurs just before Sankalpika arises. At that point a meditator might say during an interview that it feels like being in space. And the distinction between inside and outside falls away. Now it's only when this particular knowledge has been gained properly that equanimity will start to unfold. If then the meditator continues to practice, and the controlling faculties get stronger and stronger, and also well balanced, then sooner or later it may happen that the mind falls on a particular object. The object occurs in the mode of anatta, and with this, this serves as a gateway to liberation.
אם הוא ממשיך לסגר בשלב הזה וגורמי השליטה מאוזנים וגורמי ההתברות מאוזנים וזה מאוד ייתכן שיהיה על אובייקט והאובייקט הזה יהיה במוד או באופן של אנטה ושל התודעה לשחרור.
Now, what are the benefits of this contemplation of non-self? Number one, it abandons the wrongful perception of the existence of a self. And secondly, it also helps to eliminate the wrong view, the mental defilement of wrong view. And furthermore, this contemplation of non-self will also help a meditator to abandon the distortions of perception of consciousness and view. And that's it. So, let me conclude today's Dhamma talk by wishing that during your retreat here, during the last nine and a half days, and still some time to go until tomorrow, that you have gained in a clear-cut manner some an understanding of impermanence, and also a direct understanding of the unsatisfactoriness of formations, and most important of all, a direct understanding of the universal characteristic of non-self. And being equipped with this triple understanding of anicca, dukkha, and anatta, may you progress swiftly through the remaining insight knowledges, and then either during this retreat or some future retreat, see the peace and coolness of Nibbana. We have about 15 minutes left. Comments or questions? Yes? Because consciousness itself is also changing. It's coming and going. So it's not permanent. Or that which cognizes. No. So that which cognizes, again, it's just a mental function. And this in itself is impermanent, and consciousness itself is also said to be unsatisfactory. And also it shares both universal characteristics, and it follows out of this, out of these two, that it then also must be non-self. And now, yeah, Danya?
I would like to relate something to the talk. From the Webby Sassoon is a book called Tatoué à Moi, doing brain research, and how it's without being Buddhist, without mentioning.
Who is the writer?
The writer is called V.S. Ramachandran. He's a professor in.
Yes, Orly.
Actually, connected to this talk, if I could ask. Regarding.
What do you mean, observe the whole cycle?
Huh? Sometimes you observe it, everything, and sometimes you say no cut.
Oh, you mean in the interviews? Oh, well, yes. Then if you've seen a particular mental state, especially an unwholesome one, already hundreds of times, you're really familiar with it, and it keeps going on, then it's better to really cut it. The mental state that stands for cutting is effort. I don't know. So early on you observe with mindfulness, with sati, and then you make use of your effort and just.
So,
better. not under normal circumstances. Although some meditators. They are very personal in the meditation practice. So when they're working with the pain, they take this pain as a friend, and then they start sending metta to the pain. and this apparently helps observing the pain. So if you do this, okay. No, it's important to relate to an object in a proper manner. Okay. Anything else? Any other questions? Yes?
Also, not from today's talk.
They might get even more mad at you. Indeed. So, to answer both of your questions with one answer, or with one thing, namely, loving kindness. So, you can. At times in your daily life, when mindfulness is not strong enough, you might as well resort to loving kindness. And then you just do a session of 1 hour or 2 hours of loving kindness, and you start radiating loving kindness to yourself first, And you do that for maybe half an hour, 1 hour, depending on how angry yourself you are yourself. And then, if possible, you also radiate loving kindness to the other person. And you might have to do this for a longer period of time. And sooner or later, the way you see the other person will change. And then you start seeing some good qualities, and then after all you realize, well, it's not worth the it's not worth the to quarrel. And then you might see your own mistakes, you might see the other person's mistakes, and you might find, oh well, we might as well give in. And in a serious case, what you could do is, like, you spend almost the whole night, if you can't sleep anyway, you might as well use the time to radiate loving kindness. And next morning you might find a miracle, and somewhere or other the other person has also performed a change, and then you can talk to each other again. And try this, give this a try. In Lumbini, especially when setting up the center, we've had many difficult situations to cause there, and rather than getting lost in anger and making many big mistakes by being angry, it has proven to be really wonderful to resort to loving kindness. Once you've done this metta practice for some time, and if one session is not enough, well, then you continue for a couple of days or so, and sooner or later change will be there. And as we've discussed the other day already, after a while you might go and approach the other person and seek some clarification in a nice conversation. Maybe to give you an illustration from the scriptures, and it just comes to mind. At one point, some heretics, fed an elephant with liquor, and had this, pardon me? You seen this? Once I heard in Germany, on a North Sea island, Sylt. It's a place where many rich people go, and they had so much money that they decided to feed a cow champagne, a whole the bucket full of champagne, and so the cow was running around like mad. And so anyway, that elephant from the Buddha's time was being filled, being drunk, then started charging at the Buddha. What did the Buddha do? He radiated loving kindness to this elephant, Nalagiri, if I'm not mistaken, and the elephant stopped attacking the Buddha, and that was it. So this gives you an idea of how or another famous case in Burma. There was a very famous Burmese Sayadaw by the name of Metta Sayadaw, or sometimes the Burmese also called him the Daundan Deva Nasyado, Fabna Busyado, because he was just after the Second World War, he, as a Buddhist missionary monk, he went to the Qin state. Remember some time ago I mentioned Qin state, it's a frontier state. And so he went to live there. He went to live and trying to missionarize there. And he walked all across Qin state many, many, many times. And during those decades, and during the 50s and 60s and 70s, there were plenty of tigers in that state. And owing to this metta side, a strong metta, which he practiced frequently, owing to this, he was never attacked by a villager. He never even saw a tiger, even though others would see such a tiger. No. So metta provides a tremendous amount of protection for a being. Yes? Yes? Option. Yes?
So, few times you were saying, because renunciation totally happened. So then the.
Not quite. The way you're seeing it is. You see it differently. See, by renunciation is meant that you renounce, at least on a temporary basis, the worldly life. No?
The worldly, the concept of the self and everything.
Oh, you're saying in context of the self.
Renunciation would have to be of all the.
Anand, it doesn't happen that way. You cannot, by willpower, you cannot renounce anything. No, you cannot renounce the notion of a self by willpower. This happens gradually. It happens automatically in the course of mental development. It's not something that you can force.
Should happen.
It just happens.
Once
renunciation of the self happen, and then you will continue with your meditation practice. You will still want to continue because there are still plenty of other mental defilements that remain, and those are still giving you trouble. Yeah? Do you want to say in Hebrew?
I think with regard to, so she asked, if that happens and the sense of self dissolves completely, no more sense of self whatsoever, she asked, how is it possible?
I get what you're meaning. Okay. So, the answer to this is, with the attainment of the first level of enlightenment, you're not absolutely losing the sense of self. What gets eradicated or uprooted from the mind is just the wrongful belief in the existence of itself. The notion of you will still continue to make use of terms such as I and my and mine. No, this is still there. The notion of I am will be totally uprooted from the mind only in an arahant. So this is the highest level of enlightenment. And so until then, a sense, a notion of self is still there. However, as a meditator, you know that ultimately speaking, there's no reality to it. But on a conventional level, you still make use of it. Yeah, sure enough. No. So sometimes, maybe the talk is over, and then the thought arises, okay, now I will get up. So this is still there. However, once you've attained to the first level of enlightenment, the sentence or the personal pronoun, I will then get up, lacks absolute reality. Okay. No. See, behind this, there's still the mental factor of volition or intention will be working. So intention to do something, this will always be there, and that is what is driving you. It's just that the mind is deluded, and it thinks I want to do this or that. In connection with what Gaya said about modern neuroscientific research, there has been one research already quite some time ago in the 70s, I think late 70s, and so it was found that the decision to do in the mind already at an earlier point, and it's only afterwards that the mind realizes, or that the mind puts this, I want to do this or that. No. So even before before we think we want to do something, before this, the action, the decision has taken place already in the brain. I've heard of it, right?
Yeah.
But that's about it.
Yeah, but my question is not so.
It's possible. Yeah, it's possible. One would have to check very carefully, what the person's attainments are like, and the behavior is like. Well, through spiritual practice, if it leads to a letting go of the notion of a self, and it leads to truly compassionate behavior and behavior that is influenced by loving kindness and so on, well, it's good. No, there's nothing to say there. So if some spiritual person really displays a behavior that is free of greed, free of hatred, and free of pride and conceit, and free of ignorance, ignorance and restlessness, that's wonderful. And may there be many such beings. Okay, now just our last question. Oh, two more.
Everything comes and goes. How comes it
again?
We talked about diffusion.
Yeah, right.
Diffusion?
In the brain.
Action.
It happens in the brain itself. No. See, as you've seen already through your own meditation practice, there are these causal links, if you haven't eaten food for 5 days in a row, then there will be a very strong impulse to eat, and that will then initiate some process in the mind. It's a good question. This is a tricky one. Well, as human beings, let me start differently. Buddhism is not, or does not teach, fatalism. No, and Buddhism does not teach only cause and effect, but rather that there is a possibility for change, and this happens through it happens from moment to moment to moment to moment. Every time some volition or intention arises, we have an option or a choice to either choose this possibility, which let's say is unwholesome, or another possibility which is wholesome. And some people continue to choose the unwholesome options, and they get certain results. And others see that unwholesomeness doesn't bring good results, and so they start choosing wholesome actions. It's different factors involved in this. Karma or past past deeds will have an influence, plus external conditions. Let's say, owing to your past conditions, you've ended up here. No? And then, and I also, because of past conditions, end up here. And so, then this being tells, your Nama Rupa, please try to be more mindful. No? And so, with this you learn to distinguish between wholesome and unwholesome, and eventually the mind will pursue the wholesome mental states. It's something, it must be something like this. For us, sorry. It's something like this. Huh? Yeah, go ahead. Go ahead.
Maybe. Liberated, because we are all the time compulsed, yeah, by our past conditions and are unaware. Which is meant to give us more and more freedom, exactly in the sense that it's giving us factor which was not strengthened for just by practicing it in different ways, and then this factor gets very, very strong and changes our life, changes our ability to be free, changes our ability to choose, which we couldn't before, just because this factor was not present. We weren't mindful. We didn't know what mindfulness is. We never discerned what's wholesome and unwholesome. So from my own point of view, this is, and also maybe this is how I want to see it.
Yeah,
then...
I understand
that
this is coming back to the question,
but
there is no
I, there is no but this is, it's always like...
the decision to choose the first connection.
But if you think about this as a process of by intention strengthening, yeah, strengthening, right, maybe the initial intention was due to castigate, or castigate is also like due to conditions, right, so all the time this is conditions. But once you get into the circle of being aware of your intention, yeah, this awareness itself enables you to choose what's happening and to be aware of what's happening, and then by just by practicing this, being mindful, just by practicing this, you are getting more mindful.
Let me add, Ganya, what you're saying is very good. see, it's a matter of ignorance or wisdom. So as long as we don't practice, we're filled by plenty of ignorance. And like Ganya said, when we're ignorant, then we're victims of our, especially mental defilement. So we feel, there's a certain compulsion to act out of greed, to act out of hatred. We think that we choose, but in the end, we are victims of our negative emotions or negative mental states. However, with the practice of mindfulness or vipassana, gradually we're mindful, and thus we liberate us to some extent from the influence of those unwholesome mental states. And so thus new possibilities or new way becomes possible. And that then in the end leads to the cutting short of the cycle of birth and death. There's as a human being, indeed, there is the option to choose between an ethically wholesome or karmically wholesome deed or unwholesome deed. And each and every one of us is being presented with this again and again and again. Now, so let's say somebody comes and teases you. You have the, if you don't practice, you get angry at the person. If you practice meditation and you have some understanding of the mind, you realize it's no use to get angry, and you just let it be. You just let it pass. So our decision or our choices very much depend on the wisdom factor, on the ignorance or wisdom factor. And see, what is helpful in the context of this certain particular point is to make a distinction between the freedom to do what we want, freedom to say what we want, and freedom of movement, freedom of profession, and or freedom of work, the so-called liberties, which are so cherished in modern democracies. But that's just one level. Now, the freedom that the Buddha speaks of is goes much, much, much deeper, and that is the freedom from unwholesome mental states, freedom from greed, freedom from hatred, freedom from ignorance, and only that freedom in the end really counts. Already 20 minutes past 7, maybe. Last question. Okay, the very last question.
If we born, without ourselves, without even the notion of self, at what age is we get those incidents or seriously?
Well, you look at babies, and some or other in. Or somewhere or other in the development of a baby, of a young child, gradually this notion of an I comes up. And this is something learned. And as briefly touched upon early on during the talk, it has to do with latent defilements such as ignorance, craving, wrong view, and pride, pride and conceit. It's just part of one's existence as a human being. We accumulate a self.
You cannot explain why. You can just say it is factual.
As an attempted explanation, because of the fact of ignorance. Ignorance about the true nature of formations, we don't see things as, for what they truly are. So we don't understand. We don't understand that in the end there is no self. However, because our parents use, or the parents of a baby use personal pronouns such as I and mine and you and yours and so on all the time. So the child grows up with this. And then there are issues such as possessions. And this child gets something, and the other child then also craves the same object. And then the mind comes in. This is my toy and not your toy.
So the
dependent origination.
Only from the moment of the baby that is born, that they are linked.
you're the last, very last one. Oh, the interview is going to start in.
This
is a good point.
Does it really matter when it happens? Yeah. And also say that I don't think you can stop it. I don't think that you can be a good natural.
No,
human processing will happen anyway. It's not that the first one was really matter. The fact is that it's there and we are going to deal with it.
Okay, as of with these wise words, let's conclude our session.